Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The first heart transplant took place just over 50 years ago, in 1967. Today, about 5,000 are performed every year. About 2,000 of those are right here in the United States. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Dr. Jay Bama. He's a heart surgeon at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, who's performed about 100 heart transplants in his career. But first, let's talk with an Iowan who had a new heart put into her chest by Dr. Bama. Teresa Hafner of Swisher, Iowa, is with me in the studio. Teresa, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Take us back to 2015 and the condition of your original heart, the heart that you were born with, and why you needed a heart transplant.
Well, back in 2007, I flatlined a couple times when I was at work, and I was taken to the hospital and was had to have a pacemaker and defibrillator placed at that time. And I was fine for several years until then I went into heart failure. And at that point, I needed an LVAD, which is a heart pump that helps pump the blood through the heart. And we didn't have a surgeon here at the university at that time, so I went to Mayo in Rochester and had the heart pump placed. My diagnosis was familial dilated cardiomyopathy. Mm-hmm. And that kind of means that the heart gets enlarged and it races. It goes out of rhythm and it races and then it just stops. And that's what happened to me back in 06.
And so, this is just something, a condition you can be born with.
Yes, I was born with it.
And it's others in your family suffer from this?
My mom passed it on to us, and my sister Candy had it, and my other sister Cindy has it, but she doesn't have any symptoms. My sister Candy did get an LVAD, but she got an infection, and it went to her brain, and she had a major brain bleed, and we lost her last summer.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And then her daughter, a month later, she threw a lot of blood clots into her lungs, and we lost her as well.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
Thank you. So it's been kind of hard, you know,
sure,
dealing with it, and I have a lot of anger because of the disease, you know, just
that why you?
Yeah, well, not me, not that. It's just mad that this disease exists and that my family's been hit with it. You know, I can handle and have handled everything, you know, getting through it, but I don't like to see anyone else, you know, struggle with things like that. So I was very fortunate to get the LVAD and continue on.
Okay, so you've got that helps you, your heart along, helps pumping blood throughout your body. You get immediately onto a transplant wait list?
I did. I did go on the transplant wait list in Minnesota, and then we found out that was going to take a long time to get a heart. And so I transferred back to Iowa. We got a surgeon, and I wanted to be back home anyway with my family. And then, so I was on the list for 16 months.
And we have to remember, this is, we'll talk with Tony Hakes from the Iowa Donor Network later in the program, but there are a lot of people on this list for all kinds of organs, but for hearts in particular, something like 3,000 at any one time waiting for hearts as you were. So this is a wait list that you get on that you don't know.
Correct.
You will actually, your number will come up, right?
Right. And that's the hardest part, is the fear of not getting an organ in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about that wait. What goes through your mind when you're on this list waiting for a match? And it is, you know, the tragedy of someone else, another family that will be to your benefit,
right,
if I can say it that way?
True. That's very difficult because you pray for a heart. You pray that you'll get one in time. And in turn, that means that someone is going to lose their life. And I struggled with that a lot until my surgeon and my cardiologist said, you need to stop that. You know that these people are organ donors for a reason, and your time will come. And they kept saying, we're waiting for that perfect heart for you. Mm-hmm. And it was a long wait. But it is very hard to. I can remember being in the hospital when I had that infection. And I would lay there and hear the helicopter come in. And I would think, please, you know, please save this person. And if not, please be a donor. Mm-hmm. And that happened many times.
Tell me about the day that actually you did get news that you had a perfect match.
My husband and I had just had dinner, and I was upstairs watching my shows, and he was in the basement watching his. And the phone rang, and it was my cardiologist, and I was shocked because I knew what that phone call was. And I answered, and he said, "Teresa, we have the perfect heart for you." And, you know, they always say it's going to come when you least expect it, and it did. Mm-hmm. And I ran downstairs, and I'm pointing at the phone, and I'm saying, "They have a heart. They have a heart." And then something came over me, and I calmed down, and I waited for him to call back, and then we went to the hospital.
And it happened as soon as
that. It happened, yep. Mm-hmm.
And going into the transplant surgery, your last words to your husband— you don't know for sure what's going to happen, right?
Well, when I got the LVAD, I called the whole family in and said, this is how it's going to be. If this doesn't work out, I don't want to be on life support, yada, yada. You know, everything was done ahead of time. And I said, these are my wishes, and you don't make this decision. So the last thing I said to everyone was, you know, I was very calm. I was not nervous at all. I had all the faith in the university. And I just said, I love you all, and I'll see you when I wake up. Hmm. And it just, I don't know what came over me, but something did. typically, I would be pretty messed up and scared, but I wasn't scared at all. I was not afraid. Hmm. So.
And that first moment of consciousness when you did awake with a new heart, what was that like? What are your first memories of that?
My first thought was, first I saw my husband, of course, which was great. My first thought was, I made it. I made it through, and oh my gosh, I hurt. You know, it hurts.
In your chest specifically?
My chest, yeah. It hurt. And I had a lot of muscle spasms in my back, and that was worse than my chest. But it was just so much joy that I was alive, and I knew I was going to be okay. I just knew it.
You knew it immediately?
I did. I knew I was going to be okay.
That must have been an emotional moment with your
husband. It was.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Teresa Hafner of Swisher. You still live in Swisher?
I'm sorry, no. We live back closer to Muscatine.
Okay.
Yep, that's where I'm from.
Teresa is a heart transplant recipient. She was 48 at the time of the transplant in 2015. Just recounting the story of being on the wait list, getting in the heart of a donor. And we want to also include in our conversation now, Gigi Robertson joins us by phone. She is the mother of the heart donor, the heart that is in Teresa's chest. Tabitha died at the age of 26. Gigi, welcome to the program. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for joining us. And my heart goes out to you for losing your 26-year-old daughter.
Thank you.
I don't know where you would like to start, and please decline if you feel like it. Take take us back to the day of your daughter's death.
The day of her death, it was on a Monday, and just like any normal Monday, and she, her and her husband lived down in Keokuk, Iowa. And she was working up here in Burlington, Iowa, and she would call me like she always did on her way home from work. And she had let me know that they were going to go for a motorcycle ride when she got home because they were going to try for the weekend, and it didn't happen. So before he had to work, because he works third shift, they were going to go for a short ride. And I told her to be careful, and she said, "We will." And when she got home, she let me know that she was there and that she would talk to me later. And I told her to have a good time, and she said she would. And we hung up, and the day of the weather was getting kind of cloudy, and it was getting ready to start raining, and it got kind of nasty. But about 7 o'clock that evening, I got a phone call, and I thought it was from her because it came up her name. And I said hello, and there was somebody else on the line, and they said, "Is this Tabitha's mother?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And my heart just sank right then and right there, and I knew something was wrong. And I had been told that she was being taken to the Keokuk Hospital, and because her and her husband had been in a motorcycle accident. And I just freaked out. I just couldn't imagine that she was in an accident and, you know, how bad it was. I didn't know. So anyway, I had to call my husband because he was at work. So he came home and got me, and we drove down to Keokuk, and my mind was just running a mile a minute. And by the time we got down there, she was in the emergency room, and they had her hooked up to everything. She was unconscious. I didn't know how the accident happened or anything. I just knew that they'd been hit, and I was getting very panicky because I didn't know whether my son-in-law had made it or not, and because his family was there also, and I didn't have time to talk to them because I was concentrating on her. And shortly after they said they were going to rush her up to Iowa City, that I had stepped out in the hall and found out that he had passed away. So I knew that it was a bad accident, and I just was hoping and praying that Tabitha was going to be okay. And then 3 days later, I find out she's not going to be okay.
And she died in Iowa City.
She died in Iowa City 3 days after the accident.
Mm-hmm. And then it's hard to imagine. You have to make a decision. How did the idea of donating organs come up in this time of tremendous grief? I cannot imagine.
There was no question. She had already put it on her driver's license. When she first got her driver's license, when she turned 16, she put it on there that she wanted to be a donor. And I didn't realize that until after she had passed. But it did not surprise me because Tabitha was always a very caring, very loving, very giving, very helpful person. So it did not surprise me, you know, at all that she was on the donor list, you know, wanting to donate her organs.
And her heart, as we've mentioned, is the reason Teresa Hafner is alive, sitting across from me in the studio. Before we have you talk about your relationship with Teresa, tell us all the good that Tabitha's choice there in being an organ donor has done for others. Can you list?
I haven't spoken with anybody else. I mean, one person I have written letters to back and forth. Actually, I contacted him, and then there's a young gentleman that lives in the Chicago area, and he received one of her kidneys. And in the letter that he had written to me, he had basically given up. And his mother is the one that kept telling him, "You can't give up, you can't give up." And so he didn't. He finally was able to receive a kidney. And there was another gal, and she was in her 40s, and she had received the other kidney and the liver, and I had found out that she had only survived another year. But at least Tabitha had given her another year to be with her family. Mm-hmm. And I do know that her corneas went to an elderly gentleman, and she's had some of her bone and tissue have been donated to different people in different areas of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Gigi, Teresa's here. I just want to ask Teresa, you've heard this story, I think, from Gigi before. Give us your reaction to hearing a mother talk about the death of her daughter this way and the benefit that her daughter's organs have done for you and others.
It amazes me. I commend her for her strength in doing this because it breaks me up just listening to her. but I'm very thankful. And I think she knows that. You know, and all the good that Tabitha has done for others. I mean, I think that I was matched with the perfect heart. I think our hearts were matched a long, long time ago. And I think that's why I feel so comfortable with it now. And I think the other part of that is because Gigi and I are close, and we talk a lot, and we share a lot of things. And I really hope that I help her with her loss, because I will never get over that, you know, that sadness of her losing her daughter. And I'm just the luckiest girl in the world to be here.
Gigi, tell us about your relationship, how that started with Teresa.
Well, I wanted to get a hold of the Iowa Donor Network to find out how soon I could start, you know, going out, you know, trying to move forward to find out the different donors. And I was told that I couldn't do that yet. And I'm like, okay. So I had a waiting period. Well, Teresa got past that, and she had sent a letter to her representative through the Iowa Donor Network, and they contacted mine, and we were sending letters. We started sending a few letters through the Iowa Donor Network to each other. Well, then we were given the choice of contacting each other either by email or whatever. So then we started emailing each other and decided that we wanted to meet. So my representative, she asked me, her name's Linda Harvey, and she had asked me, she goes, where do you want to do this? And I said, I want to do it at the hospital, because that's where it all began. And so we met, and it was like meeting an old friend, you know, and I was thrilled to death to be able to get to know Teresa, and I got to listen to my daughter's heart, which was a blessing, and my husband and my younger son was with me, and it was just, and Teresa had her family with her, and it just was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Are they, I mean, they must be in a similar way. You must feel like family, Gigi.
Yes.
You feel the same way, Teresa.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
That moment you described, Gigi, of listening to your daughter's heart in Teresa. Describe that.
It was kind of nerve-wracking. I mean, not in a bad way. It just was exciting. I got to hear Tabitha's heart. I knew that part of her was still alive, and she wouldn't have wanted it any other way. And when I got, the more I got to know, have gotten to know Teresa, she would be somebody that Tabitha would have, you know, connected with no matter what. But in this way, it's through the heart. So I'm just glad that Tabitha's heart matched Teresa, and we're able to be together again in one way or another.
Your daughter, Tabitha, I understand, left behind a daughter.
Yes, she did.
Has she met Teresa?
No, not yet.
Do you plan that?
In the future, yes. I want her to, but her father kind of feels like she's still a little young. She's only 7.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had to deal with a lot. She lost her stepdad and her mother, and
yeah.
So it's just been kind of hard, you know, but...
And she doesn't know at this point that her mother's heart is still beating.
No.
That will be a moment.
Yeah. And last year when Teresa and I did our speeches at the Donate Life Day up at the University of Iowa Hospital, we did our speeches, and then Teresa and Linda Harvey had presented me with one, they're called a life beat, or not a life beat. Anyway, it's a pillow that has Tabitha's heartbeat recorded in it. They had given that to me. So it's And I've needed it. There's been times that I've really needed it. And I'm just glad that I was thrilled to death that when they gave it to me.
What a story. What an experience. Gigi, I want to include, before we take a break here, Tony Hakes is with us, Public Outreach Supervisor for the Iowa Donor Network. You've been sitting here quietly in the studio here in Iowa City. Welcome to the program, Tony.
Thank you, Ben.
Wow. This is a story that's repeated in various different ways so many times, but unfortunately not enough, because there are waiting lists for all kinds of organs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's, at any given time, 700 people on the wait list in Iowa and 120,000 nationwide waiting for that life-saving transplant.
This is specifically heart transplant?
This is all organs.
This is all organs.
Yeah.
And that decision to be an organ donor, do you know why, when people do not want to be organ donors? Because it's asked here in Iowa when you renew your license, right? Do you know anything about why people would say no?
We do. And in Iowa, fortunately, we've got tremendous support for organ donation. About 70% of adults are already registered, which is good enough for number 9 in the country percentage-wise. So Iowa's a great place, very giving people, very intelligent people. Donation just makes sense. And we know that Iowans really support donation, which is why, you know, some of our wait lists are a little bit shorter, and we have great health care and great surgeons. So it is a good place to be listed. And I've heard Teresa and Gigi's story several times, but it still gives me goosebumps sitting here having them retell it, because donation is still very rare. And it's incredibly powerful. Teresa is alive today because someone else said yes to donation. What we're seeing is that 30% of Iowans that aren't registered, we want to see them register. And a lot of times there's some misconceptions around donation that people think maybe I'm too old, or I've got a bad health history, or, you know, the hospital or EMS providers won't try to save my life. And that's all, of course, false.
Right. And it's only when you're pronounced completely dead that then,
yep,
this would be put into action.
Yep. Someone has to be pronounced dead before the donation process would even begin. So it's a chance for Iowans to really go out and help other people and save their lives.
Okay, Tony Hakes is with us. He'll stay with us in the second half hour. Also, Teresa Hafner, heart transplant recipient. Gigi Robertson, the mother of Tabitha, who died in a motorcycle accident in 2015. Her heart beats on in Teresa Hafner. And it's an amazing story. When we come back, we'll hear from Dr. Jay Bama. He was the heart surgeon who performed this transplant. He'll take us through the process. It's really amazing. I spoke with him earlier this morning. He's actually doing his work right now. So I spoke with him earlier this morning. When we come back, you will hear exactly what takes place, what took place with Teresa when a heart transplant happens, when we come back. It's an amazing story, and it's all about the Iowa Donor Network. We'll hear from more from Tony, Gigi, and Teresa. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, exploring what it's like to have a heart transplant. The first heart transplant took place just over 50 years ago. That was way back in 1967. That patient lived for 18 hours after the transplant. Today, about 5,000 heart transplants are performed worldwide every year, about 2,000 of those right here in the United States. My guests, the dramatic story we heard the first half hour of Teresa Hafner, she's with us, heart transplant recipient, 48 at the time of the transplant in 2015. She would not have lived without a new heart. Gigi Robertson is with us, the mother of Tabitha, who died in 2015 in a motorcycle accident along with her husband. She became the donor. That is the heart, Tabitha's heart, beating in Teresa's body to this day. Tony Hakes is with us of the Iowa Donor Network. We'll hear more from them toward the end of the hour, but first, let's get a better idea of what happens during a heart transplant. The heart surgeon who performed Teresa's transplant couldn't join us live, was available earlier today. I spoke with Dr. Jay Bama, cardiothoracic surgeon at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City, chief of adult cardiac surgery and director of heart transplant and mechanical circulatory support. I began by mentioning that about a dozen heart transplants are performed each year at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, and I asked him how many he had done so far in his career.
So in my career, I've done over 100 heart transplants, probably closer to 150 if you count the ones I did during my training as well.
Mm-hmm. And we understand that you also performed the heart transplant for Teresa Hafner.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. I understand a heart transplant usually needs to occur within just a few hours of the organ removal from the donor, in this case, a 26-year-old victim of a motorcycle crash, in order for that organ to remain usable. You have to be ready at a moment's notice, more or less.
That's right, Ben. So the heart is a very sensitive organ, obviously, and so it's very sensitive to anything done to it, and especially the sort of things that we do to it when we do transplantation. And so it's very important that we time these events properly so that the heart is outside of the body for as little time as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep very close communication between two teams, a transplant team at the hospital and then a donor team that goes out to assess the donor. And by staying in close communication, we're able to time things such that when the donor procedure is performed, the heart is removed from the donor's body and preserved, placed under ice to protect it, and then transported back to the university for implantation into the recipient, that the timing is done such that the amount of time the heart is actually out of the body and not receiving a blood supply is as little as possible.
Mm-hmm. So that tells me that even though we can transport it, get it on ice, so to speak, that it will generally be a heart from this area or very close to the Midwest. Is that right?
That's correct. In some situations, we've traveled further distances to receive donor hearts, but it's very dependent upon the situation with the donor and the recipient.
Mm-hmm. If I'm getting a big picture here and looking at statistics, there are many more, several thousand people in the United States at any one time waiting for a heart transplant who have been deemed needing a heart transplant. So there's a big waiting list there. So you have people waiting, and then you are waiting for donors to be there, right? So what other things have to line up for this to happen?
That's correct. The need for heart transplant tremendously outweighs the availability of donor hearts. And so we have a significant number of patients out there that are potentially in need or frankly in need of heart replacement surgery. They are facing death without a new heart. Now, we have a number of new technologies that allow us to support those patients while they wait. And so we're able to keep most of the patients alive using artificial heart technology.
Okay, let's go back to the case of a heart transplant similar to what Teresa Hafner, how you transplanted a new heart into her body. So she's on the waiting list. A donor comes. A donor is declared legally dead. That person, or I guess parents, can say, okay, we will donate organs. So when do you enter the picture? How do you get word? Take us through that process.
There's the donor network that essentially is called anytime there's a potential donor, someone who's died, suffered brain death, that the physicians caring for them believe that they would potentially be a donor. And they go to the hospital, assess the patient, and if the patient is deemed an appropriate candidate to donate organs, then they then refer to a ongoing list that they keep where they look at donors recipients across the country, and there is a matching process by which they match the organ to a recipient. And so we're notified when we have a donor matched to one of our recipients, and then we can assess the donor. A lot of times we will request other studies to evaluate the heart function, and then once we deem that the heart is good quality and acceptable for transplantation, then we would accept the heart and we would make arrangements for a donor team from our center to go out to that hospital and physically evaluate the donor heart in person.
Mm-hmm. And assuming that heart is in good shape and it would be a good match for the recipient, it is flown to Iowa City where your team is ready.
Correct. Usually we time things such that when the donor heart arrives, we've already initiated the surgery so that we can immediately remove the recipient's diseased heart and then implant the new donor's healthy heart.
Okay, so the recipient, without the heart perhaps even being, would be in transit to Iowa City. You've already opened the chest with an incision from roughly below the Adam's apple right down to the above the navel, right, to separate the chest bone.
Correct. We usually initiate the operation once we know that the donor heart is a good quality, and we typically will start the procedure but wait for the donor heart to arrive here in the city before we actually remove the recipient's heart. The incision is, those are sort of more historic incisions that were that big. We're able to do these operations through smaller incisions these days, and so our incision typically starts from just below the little notch up at the top of the breastbone,
mm-hmm.
just below that, and goes down just above where the breastbone ends. So it's about a 6-inch, incision.
Is the donor heart immediately attached in place, or is there a machine that is sort of in between there in that step?
In order to remove the recipient's heart, we have to place the recipient on a heart-lung machine. The heart-lung machine is designed to circulate blood through the body, remove carbon dioxide, add oxygen, and we also can use it to adjust the temperature of the body. And so the patient, the recipient, is placed on this artificial heart-lung machine to keep the recipient alive as we then work to remove the recipient's heart. And eventually, once we have removed the heart, we're looking into the chest and seeing a chest, that is essentially empty without, the life-giving organ, the heart, in there. And it's a very sort of surreal thing to see. We're heart surgeons, so we're used to seeing and operating on a heart that's there. And when we take it out, it's a very surreal thing to see that the chest cavity is there open with no heart in it.
Mm-hmm. You've done about 100 heart transplants. Is that the moment that a critical moment, the critical moment, above all others?
Well, that's I think, sort of the moment that's always exhilarating and always a little anxiety-provoking, because now you've removed the organ that gives life. And so when we then get the heart, the donor heart, we typically unpackage it. It's packed in ice. We evaluate it, make sure there's no sort of things that need to be done to correct problems with the heart. Occasionally, patients have small little holes at the top part of their heart that we have to close. Usually, we do that, and then we start the implant procedure. And we connect the different portions of the heart from the donor to the recipient, such that we can then start blood flowing back through the heart. And that's what sort of reanimates the heart and starts it back to life.
That must be an emotional moment for you and your team.
It's a very emotional moment, and I can tell you it's very exciting, and it's one of those moments, one of those sort of events that no matter how many times you see it, it's always as exciting as the first. So I've seen it over 100 times, and every time I see it, it's like the first time.
Roughly, correct me if I'm wrong, about 5,000 of these done in the world a year, a couple thousand of them in the U.S. You have done 100 of them in your career so far. Dr. Bama, how do you prepare for a heart transplant procedure? This lasts several hours. Do you feel extra pressure? Do you have to do any sort of mental preparation to make sure you are on the top of your game?
Absolutely, Ben. It's always... these procedures can be very time-consuming operations, and so we, strive always to, maintain the best, physical and emotional health as we're going into these complicated procedures. I can tell you that I wouldn't be able to do any of this work if it wasn't for the tremendous team that I have working with me to support me and help support the patient. Probably the most difficult aspect in these procedures is managing the timing. And so, you know, being able to, you know, really put a lot of emphasis on communication and timely communication with all the members of the team is essential to achieve a success. I've become myself quite accustomed to doing these long operations and don't do anything particularly special, but, you know, it's always a something that we try to keep in mind to keep ourselves in good health.
And, imagine you have adrenaline to keep you going. It's not
absolutely and coffee.
And coffee. The first heart transplant quite a time ago in 1967. That first heart transplant patient survived for 18 days. What is the outlook for, generally speaking, for a patient with a new heart these days?
So the outlook has tremendously improved. Those early experiences with heart transplant were before the days of modern immunosuppression medications, which came about in the early 80s. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, from the first heart transplant up to that sort of time period, you know, heart transplants were done sporadically and not with the best outcomes.
And when you say immunosuppressant, the biggest risk has been a rejection of the donor heart.
Correct. Without immunosuppressants, the body's immune system is able to recognize that the tissue is foreign, and it mounts a tremendous attack against the heart, just as it would against bacteria, other foreign bodies that would enter the bloodstream. And so with the advent of better immunosuppression that occurred in the early 80s, particularly cyclosporin, heart transplantation outcomes improved dramatically and allowed it to become an actual therapeutic option for patients with heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've become a lot better with regards to immunosuppression. Things have improved tremendously. And these days for patients undergoing heart transplantation, we measure survival in decades. And so we're happy that we can see longer-term survival than what was seen in the past, with most patients living upwards of 10 years.
Going back to the feeling you must have putting a new heart in someone's chest and bringing that heart to life and letting that person live, you've done about 100 heart transplants. Is there a moment that you recall that, I mean, they all must be incredible moments to be able to succeed in this way, but is there a special moment that you sort of bring to mind, perhaps an early transplant that that you were involved in that you could tell us about?
Yeah, you know, the transplants are also, you know, very special to us. You know, transplant surgeons who do this really make a tremendous commitment to their career and to their patients to be able to, you know, take care of such sick patients and do these operations that are most of the times in the middle of the night. Every transplant has been tremendously special to me. I remember very vividly a transplant that I did before I got here to Iowa that I was in when I was in Pittsburgh on a young lady who had a very unusual cardiac problem that involved the right side of the heart. It had, you know, basically completely disabled her. She was a mother of two young kids at that time and was really struggling to take care of her family. And we were blessed to get a heart on Christmas Day. This was many years ago, and I did a heart transplant for her on Christmas Day, and she had a tremendous quick recovery, got back to great health, and went back to taking care of her family. And that transplant's always been very special to me. It's always reminded me of the great power that we have with heart transplantation and why, you know, we need to continue to, build and develop heart transplantation and continue to resource it well. And most importantly, to continue to be recognizing and thankful for the donors who, you know, give that great, tremendous gift of life, you know.
Indeed.
You know, that is, you know, something that that transplant always is always one that I remember very fondly, of course. And but every transplant is a special moment and a special opportunity for the entire transplant team.
Dr. Jay Bama, thank you so much for your time and for describing your work and your life's passion here.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
Conversation with Dr. Bama recorded earlier today. Ben Kiefer with Teresa Hafner now live, Gigi Robertson and Tony Hakes. Teresa Hafner is a heart transplant recipient. Gigi Robertson, the mother of Tabitha, who died in 2015. Her heart beats on in Teresa Hafner and allows her to continue living. We've heard that conversation with the surgeon, the cardiothoracic surgeon at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Dr. Bama, who performed this surgery. Gigi Robertson, any closing thoughts or thoughts you have in listening to the after listening to the perspective of the surgeon who performed this surgery? Gigi, are you still there? We may have lost Gigi or simply can't hear her. What about your thoughts, Teresa Hafner, after hearing that? I don't know if you'd heard that perspective to that degree.
No, I've never really I never heard that, but I don't doubt it at all. I had all the faith in him from the first time I met him. So,
and what an emotional experience it is for the surgeon and for his entire team.
Yeah, I can imagine. And just his promise to me the first time I met him, and we're going to get this done. And he's right. The team that they have is unbelievable, and it's great. Yeah.
Talk about, and I don't know, you can talk about yourself, but the degree to you know other heart transplant recipients, the degree to which your emotional state, your mental state, before, during, and after, contributes to the success here, Teresa. What do you think?
You have to stay positive. I mean, it's easy to get down and to get, you know, just want to give up because it's so hard. The fear is the worst.
Mm-hmm.
But I just tried to remain positive and stay strong. I had a ton of support with my family, my husband's family, you know, my siblings. It's you can't do it by yourself,
right,
for sure.
Tony, I wanted to have a couple minutes for you before we end this hour. What's left unmentioned? Of course, we want to mention info, contact information about the Iowa Donor Network, and what else do we need to get in before the hour is over?
Well, we really just want to encourage everyone to register as a donor. If you don't have a Y on your license next to donor on the front, you can go online to iowadonornetwork.org and register there. But it's really important to have that conversation with your family. You know, make sure everyone kind of sits down and says, this is what I want. Make sure they know and understand your wishes, and you really know and understand theirs.
Mm-hmm. And we know from Gigi, who's back on the line. Hi, Gigi.
Hi.
Yeah, we were just, Tony was going through contacting the Iowa Donor Network, get that changed on your license to a Y, a yes. You didn't know, but we're not surprised then that your daughter had agreed to be an organ donor.
Right.
And that's so very important. Gigi, after listening to the surgeon perform, does that give you a different perspective? I mean, an emotional, extraordinary experience for the team who performs this operation as well.
It was an eye-opener. And, I mean, I knew that there was a lot to it. And it just, I don't know, I guess it just kind of made me, when he was talking about if they didn't give him the medication, it would, you know, deny the heart and all that. And I'm just thankful that they can do things like that. And people that need it, like Teresa, was able to get the heart, and it is in her and it's working well. And I mean, it was a lot of information I did not know, but now I know it, and I'm glad that I got to hear what all it entails.
Gigi, we are so grateful that you shared your story this hour. Not an easy story to tell about your daughter's death, but so many benefits that came from her organ donations. Gigi, thank you very much for being on our program today.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Teresa Hafner, heart transplant recipient, for sharing your story.
Thanks, Ben.
We wish you, of course, a long life with Tabitha's heart.
Thank you.
And Tony Hakes, public outreach supervisor for the Iowa Donor Network. Give us quick contact information before we go.
www.iowadonornetwork.org.
Thank you, Tony, Gigi, and Teresa.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Help today also from Lulu Dewey. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.